The views expressed on this show by guests and the hosts on issues outside of the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence are the opinions of those individuals alone and do not necessarily reflect those of architects and engineers for 9/11 truth.
Welcome to 9/11 Freefall. I'm the host, Andy Steele. Today we're joined by William Veal. He was a chief assistant public defender in Contra Costa County, California, supervising the first alternate defender office in the country to handle felony cases. After his retirement, he was part of a team that represented Pentagon worker April Gallup in a lawsuit against Bush administration officials, alleging that they purposely allowed the attack on the Pentagon to happen. We'll hear more about it from his own mouth in just a few minutes, but he's got a book out now called 9/11, The Awful Truth. We'll be talking about that book today as well. Mr. Veal, thank you so much for coming on 9/11 Freefall today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
And it's been a long time the show's been on the air, and I have yet to have you on the show and hear your story. And you're somebody that has gone to bat for 9/11 truth, but we'll get into all of that. I like to start from square one. And in doing that, I'm going to ask you, please tell us more about your career as a public defender. What was that like for all those years?
Well, being a public defender is a very interesting and a very difficult job. With great highs and terrible lows. I basically was a trial lawyer, criminal trial lawyer, and I represented people who couldn't afford their own lawyer to be hired privately. And I did every kind of state case that you can do. I spent most of my last 15, 20 years doing death penalty work. And I tried a number of death penalty cases. So I spent a lot of my time in court, and you learn how to deal with evidence in situations like that. And I suppose I just would have retired comfortably and quietly. But a friend of mine threw a copy of David Ray Griffin's book, New Pearl Harbor, across the desk at me when I went in to talk about something else in the office one day. And my life has not been the same since.
No, absolutely not. This is the case with so many of us when we first wake up to this issue. It is something that turns your whole worldview on its head, and at first there's confusion. At least for the people who woke up and did something about it, there was initial confusion. Some people just turn their brains off and refuse to look at it, and they go off in another direction. But there is confusion, and then you get a new understanding of the world. I mean, how much did your worldview shift after learning some of the truths about that day? I mean, were you open to this kind of knowledge beforehand, or was this something that was completely out of left field for you?
Yeah, fair question. I think broadly, I mean, I've just done a fair study of history and was certainly aware of the Tonkin Gulf situation. I don't think I would have been able to point to Mukden, for example. I knew about the Reichstag fire. So the idea of false flag was kind of in background. I'd read some things about it. But when the notion first occurred to me of an inside job with regard to 9/11, I was actually driving in San Francisco, and I came across an inside job rally. And I just said to myself, what in the world, you know? And I came back and I banged around the computer a bit, and I saw a notion that no plane had hit the Pentagon. And I laughed out loud. There was nobody else in the room. I laughed out loud. And I turned the thing off. And I said, this is, you know, come on. So I was one of the best possible people to have to have this business directed at me, because I was so completely looking in the other direction, if you would. Then when the guy, my friend, showed me that book, I read the book, and I read the entire book, and then I read, 30 more and all kinds of documents and scholarly papers and things like that since. So, in a way, I was open to it, but in a very serious way, I wasn't, because I laughed at it when I first heard about it.
Yeah, same thing with me. I didn't get offended. I just dismissed it. Now, let's talk about April Gallup. For people who are not familiar with her case, we may have newcomers to the movement in the last year who are just catching up to this entire story of 9/11 truth. Please tell them about it. Tell them who April Gallup was, how you got involved with her case, and what were the grounds for the original lawsuit?
Okay, well, April was a distinguished soldier who worked at the Pentagon, which is an honor in itself. And so she was in the building at the time that whatever happened there happened there. And she was there with her little son, who was just 3 or 4 months old at that time. And she managed to get out of the building and collapse on the ground outside. And as the weeks and months went by, she learned what she said. They told her what had happened. There's some airliner had flown into the building, and nothing in her memory could square with that. And so she thought that there was a problem. So she became active in the sense of going to the various hearings and things like that. And she saw Donald Rumsfeld testifying before the 9/11 commission, and she didn't believe what he was saying, and he wouldn't answer the questions properly, and he was kind of tap dancing all over the place. And so at some point or another, she gave an interview to a journalist who and said the basic notion that she couldn't believe that a plane hit the Pentagon because she walked out of a hole that whatever the bomb, whatever went off there, created. I had that time as already part of the movement, I guess we would say. And she was put in contact with me, and we interviewed her. My friend Dennis Cunningham is a famous civil rights lawyer. He and I decided that we should do something about this if we could. And so we interviewed her, and we decided that a complaint should be filed, because she was injured as a result of this attack. And the first and most important thing about the attack was the fact that the Pentagon was hit. And in order for the Pentagon to have been hit, the first notion is that there must have been somebody on the inside turning all the defenses off. And you don't have to look very far to find out that there, in fact, was just that. And so we then learn about the activities of Dick Cheney at the time, Vice President of the United States. He was in the Presidential Emergency Operations Center that morning, and according to Norm Mineta, he was the only Democrat in the cabinet, and was the Secretary of Transportation. He was escorted down to the PIOC, if you will, that morning around 9:15 or 9:20, maybe a little later. And when he got there, Cheney was in charge and giving instructions and things like that. And as Mineta was watching what was going on, a gentleman, a military officer, put his head in the room and said, Mr. Cheney, the plane is 50 miles out, and then walked out the door and came back in a little bit later and said, plane is 30 miles out, sir. And then came back in a minute or so later and said, sir, the plane is 10 miles out. Do the orders still stand? And Cheney, according to Mineta, whipped his neck around and looked at the guy and said, of course they still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary? And minutes later, they got notice that the Pentagon was up in smoke. So that was the most important piece of testimony, and remains, in my opinion, the most important piece of testimony about 9/11, because there are only two choices about what those orders were. One is that the order was to stand down, in essence, to whatever defenses that we have to the Pentagon. We want that plane to be immune to them. And the second possibility is that the orders were to shoot down that plane. Well, we know that that plane was not shot down. And what happens in the United States military, at least on paper, is when there's something, there's an order that's not followed out, there's an inquiry, and there are boards of inquiry, and there are court martials, things like that, that make people be held accountable for their failures. That's the best way to prevent them in the future. And so we know by the fact that all the people who were involved in this attack in the Pentagon were all promoted after this attack as opposed to disciplined. We know that the order was not to shoot down a plane. The order was to stand down the defenses. So that's the most important piece of evidence that we have. And we have it against the person that we could actually take to court right now if we could. And that's what I tried to do in the lawsuit. We filed the lawsuit against Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and Richard Myers, who was at that point the acting joint chiefs of chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, excuse me. We filed a lawsuit to go on, and the United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York, which is where the lawsuit had to be filed, responded that the idea was ridiculous and that it should be the case should be dismissed. Well, when we got that papers, we filed a motion or responded to that motion saying this was could not be a frivolous lawsuit. It was based in fact, and how could what we say be frivolous when in fact it's true? So when we made our initial allegations about the Pentagon, we didn't include anything about New York. We were going to try to kind of sidle into the whole issue because the issue is so difficult. Generally, we thought the best thing to do is just focus on Virginia, what happened to the Pentagon and April Gallup first, and then we will amend our complaint later on with the matters of what took place in New York. And so we filed 60 pages of affidavits demonstrating what had happened in New York and everything else. Well, the case was ultimately dismissed. Judge Denny Chin decided that it was our allegations were the product of cynical delusion and fantasy, and didn't deal with any of the 60 pages of affidavits that we had filed. We then appealed to the Second Circuit, and they agreed with Denny Chin, and in fact sanctioned us for filing a frivolous lawsuit. And never dealt with any of the facts about Cheney that we kept put in our complaint. The dishonesty with which they dealt with the case is breathtaking, really, because the most important thing we said was that Cheney was giving orders about this element of the offense, this instrumentality of the crime, at the time of the crime and the place of the crime, and those facts were not even mentioned. We put them all in our complaint, but when the response came from the U.S. attorney and the response came from the district court and the response came from the Second Circuit, those facts were never mentioned. It is as if, I think I said in the complaint, one of the papers, someone was reviewing an indictment for a liquor store holdup, and they decided, and for some reason or another, it didn't mention the fact that they saw the defendant go into the store with a gun. They left that part out. It's just exactly the same thing to fail to mention Cheney under these circumstances. So that's where we are. That was 10 years ago, pretty close. And we had a publisher who said that she would publish the book that we were going to write. She told us to write a book, and we did, or I did. And then in 2014 or so, when it was all together and we were submitting it to the publisher decided that she wasn't going to do it, or the publisher decided they weren't going to do it. So I kind of put it away for 4 years, and then in 2018 got interested in it again, and then finished up working on it a number of months ago and published a daggone thing myself. So there it is for anybody to read who wants to know what I did. And it includes the latest stuff that I'm aware of. The most interesting piece of factual material. So it's an opportunity for people to just see one man's disaster played out before them.
I think the most accurate stuff is the stuff that people have to publish themselves, because if it honestly tells the truth, then of course corporate institutions like these publishing companies aren't going to want to touch it. I mean, I've been in bookstores a couple of times over the years, and besides your obvious fiction stuff, your history and your current events books are really just celebrities in the political world aggrandizing themselves now. You see a picture of them looking off distantly like heroes. Basically, a lot of times, too, it's a forerunner to a presidential campaign or something like that, but just absolute trash, not even worth looking at. So you got to go to the indies out there, the independent publishers, the independent filmmakers to get anything that is of any quality and of any factual basis, the people doing it because they care about the truth and looking for some greater agenda. They know they're not going to make a ton of money off of it. So I commend you for doing that and taking that initiative and standing by your work, even if the publisher wouldn't stand by you, and also standing by the work that you did regarding April Gallup. I'm curious, just before we start talking about the meat and potatoes of the book, did you have any idea that it would go in this direction, or were you just completely surprised by the level of censure that you received as a result of bringing this case to the court?
Yeah, no, I think that's a very important, or at least it's important to me. And the answer is, we knew that we weren't going to win. But we simply did not know how we were going to lose. And what is absolutely clear is that we did not have any idea of the depth to which the four judges would go, shredding their oaths, lying, ignoring evidence, looking at the precedents that need to be applied and just forgetting about them. That we had no idea was going to take place. And we, we're lawyers, so we know a bunch of lawyers and judges and things like that. And we submitted our stuff to many people to kind of check it with us. And nobody suggested that you're looking at sanctions here if you say this, or they're just going to lie to this extent and that's how they'll take care of you. So that was a total surprise. We knew we were going to lose because we were up against the most powerful forces in the universe, but we just did not conceive of them going to the depths and the lengths that they did.
Absolutely ridiculous. Let's get into the book. It's called 9/11, The Awful Truth. It's available on Amazon. And in fact, folks, I'm going to link the Amazon page to the description under the show this week so you can find it there and buy it. But Bill, tell us a little bit more of what this book is about.
It's a memoir. What I did was I talked about my relationship to the case and the facts of 9/11, but the fact is that initially when it took place, I thought, at least when I got into it, I decided that this is a political problem. Lawsuits, I'm a criminal lawyer, I'm not a civil lawyer, so I had no business in civil court, I said this is a political problem. So I said. Why don't I run for Senate, this is where this should be. And so I wrote speeches and I put them on the internet. Had a website called VealTruth.com, which I put up there after I retired in 2006 from my public defending gig. And I thought, what we need to do is we need to get, people to read these books that I've read. And get the journalists, and to provoke, make sure, that they understand people are watching. Just come on, deal with this thing. So I went, I went around to journalists and I wrote them. I wrote letters to countless people. And that's, they all, not all of the letters, but a sampling of them that are in the book. But then I would travel around and I, went to actual people's homes and to their businesses. And things like that. I managed to get a couple of in-person interviews with, for example, Walter Pincus of the Washington Post, who is the grandfather of investigative journalism in this country. And I had an hour and a half with him over oatmeal one morning in D.C. I had another interview with a guy named Philip Sheenan, who wrote a book called The Commission, that I think might have won a Pulitzer Prize, I'm not sure, about the 9/11 Commission, where I, you know, asked him about very concrete problems that he did not deal with in his book. It's interesting, those are two examples. Walter Pincus never, you know, the idea that the government could have been involved in this abysmal disaster here never occurred to him. It literally was not something that he could even think about. And when I talked to him more, he kind of said, oh, well, how about this for an explanation for that, you know, just off the top of his head. And he made a couple of valiant stabs, but it wasn't even close. And so then when I left, you know, he'd done as much as he could do. He had no answers to any of the questions that I had. I sent him a kind of a brief, you know, 3 or 4 page letter saying, what about, could you address these particular issues one by one so that we could have something to discuss? And, you know, I never heard from him. Phil Sheehan, on the other hand, I walked into his room, into the Starbucks in DuPont Circle in Washington, and handed him Barton Gellman's book, The Angler, about Cheney, and showed him the pages where he talked about what happened that morning and when Cheney got to Piak. And Sheehan looked at that and read that and said, well, you know, that's simply not true. I said, I understand it's not true, but I want to know, you know, why didn't you talk about Mineta when you wrote your book? You know, Barton Gellman, actually, I called him up and I got him on the phone, which is amazing. Now you can't do that particularly. I got him on the phone and I said, listen, did you have a chance to, did you interview Mineta? And he said, I didn't get to it. I said, why not? He said, well, I had all these other records. I had no reason to believe that he wasn't, that they, these records weren't true. Well, I said, okay, fine. Then he was on deadline, so I couldn't talk to him anymore. He left out, and his account left out, and Cheney's account leaves out 33 minutes after the second tower is hit, where supposedly he's sitting in his office there waiting for the Secret Service to come in and drag him out of there. Now, that's simply not what happened. We know that because we know, you know, generally speaking, what goes on with the Secret Service. We know because I actually asked the Secret Service agent at the White House one day when I was there just for a garden tour. I said, how long would it have taken for Cheney to be out of his office within after the second tower hit? He said seconds. So I know that that's not true, and we know it's not true for all kinds of documents which have come to light since. I began writing the book, or since we did our case. Wonderful journalists have done FOIA requests and gotten all kinds of documents since, and we know that Cheney was in the PIOC at 9, by the time the Pentagon was hit anyway, by 9:30 or so, and we've got it from maybe 5 different sources, including, and the important one I think is mostly, is from Ashley Estes, who is the secretary to George Bush. And she tells a story to I think it was 60 Minutes 2 was interviewing her about the morning, and she gave this statement, which I got a copy of from the White House, which says, you know, I was sitting there and watching the television, and then I heard this banging in the hallway, and there goes the vice president out of the door. You know, and he was being dragged down the hall by the Secret Service agents, and that was right after the second tower hit. That's precisely what happened. And when Gellman wrote his book, he left out those 33 minutes and adopted some other timeline that the vice president thought was okay for him. So anyway, when I handed that book to Phil Sheehan, he said, that's not true. But I said, well, why didn't you include in your account an interview with Mineta? And he said, you know, I don't know. I think, I can't remember now why I didn't go into it. He said, but I don't think, you know, Mineta was an old guy. You know, maybe it was the fog of war. He didn't understand things the way they were actually taking place. But he had no evidence for any of those things. And he said, you know, I've kind of moved on, and I haven't been thinking about this for a long time. He said, but importantly, he said, but if I miss this story, it's the biggest story. And it is, I can't remember the word that he actually used, but it suggested that he would have an abysmal view of his own performance if he missed the story, which he did.
Just for you, I mean, we're in our last few minutes here. I ask this question sometimes of guests, and I'm going to ask it of you because you have been personally affected by your work with 9/11 Truth, particularly in the April Gallup case. So I want to know, what keeps you going? What keeps you hopeful? What keeps you publishing books so many years after this, even though you've been personally affected? What keeps you in the game?
Yeah, there's sort of a general reaction that I have to what I consider to be the denial. When you put the facts as you and I know them before, you know, really good journalists, Matt Taibbi, for example, he and I have had email exchanges and things like that where he's accused me of wearing a tinfoil hat. But I respond with questions. I say, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? And I get no response. And so the question then becomes, you know, to what extent is this denial? And to what extent are people lying to themselves? Or to what extent are they unable to sleep at night because of what they know they're doing by not bringing forth what they have? I don't know. It's a drive to get to people, you know, to have them have it put before them so that they have to say, no, that's not true, or I have no explanation for that. It's why we're never getting anywhere until we get two people who know what they're talking about in the room, one on either side of the question. I would love to have an opportunity to be on the radio with Matt Taibbi or somebody like that so that I ask them, well, what about, what do you say about this? What about this? What about this? So I published the book because I needed to get it off of my plate. It's been sitting there for so long, I wanted to get it done. But, you know, there's lots of things going on, and I've got, you know, I'm in contact with people who are investigating still. And so I wanted to include those matters in the book and give people an opportunity to see as much as I have seen. So that's why I keep going. I don't know. I'm not going to do anything beyond this, I don't think, at this point, even though if I were, you know, 60 years old instead of 72, I would file a lawsuit against Cheney today. And Rumsfeld, I'd do it all again. And we wouldn't make the mistake that we made the first time with not including the New York allegations. All of that would have been in there. That's what we'd do if I were to do it today. And any judge would have an enormous problem if they had to deal with all of that stuff all in one complaint. And that's what we should have done. We made a tactical decision to not include the stuff in New York initially. And so they were able to cheat. In my opinion, it's totally cheating not to deal with it in the second response. But anyway, we wouldn't make that mistake second time if I were 60, but I'm not.
Well, God bless you for the work that you have done and setting the precedent, laying the groundwork for future activists, lawyers, and such. I think the story is not finished. I think that we're going to have justice on this issue at one point, and it is going to shake the world. And it's going to be because of people like you and people in the audience doing everything that they do in so many different ways and methods. But yeah, it's coming. It's coming. We're going to shake the world up. Bill Veal, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for coming on 9/11 Free Fall today.
Thanks for having me, sir. Take care.
This program is on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific, and every other Sunday night on BBS Radio at 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 o'clock Pacific. You can also keep track of the archives by going to 911freefall.com. This is Andy Steele. Have a great week. Good luck.